Okay, thanks a lot. We'll just grab a seat and we'll get started. This is going to be a little bit of an awkward setup because I will be shown code later on, which I want to point to. So I'm going to have to dance about the stage and make the cameraman work for his living. So that'll be good. All right, so let's crack on. So this is me. As Amy said, my name is Gary Short. I'm a Microsoft MVP. I'm a freelance consultant in data science and big data. This is pretty much where I live. The most important things on the slides is this is how to get in contact with me if you have a question that you think of later on in the day. Obviously, there'll be time for questions at the end of this session, but you know, not everybody can think of the questions they want to ask just at the end of the session. So if you're in another session or you're looking around the expo later on today and you think of a question that you've got, then please feel free either to email me or send me a tweet with your question. So that's me. What about you guys? How many people here are actual coders, developers, write code for a living? Excellent. Who's never seen a line of code before in their life? All right, nobody, that's good. Hands up here who's C-sharp developers, mostly. Excellent. Put your hands up if you're not a C-sharp developer. All right, what are you coding? Python, yeah. What else have we got?
VBA.
VBA, is that a language? Yeah, okay. Almost.
M,
yeah, okay, cool. Yourself?
Node.
Node.js. All right. Okay, so they're all kind of fairly similar languages. We'll probably get on all right with the code that I've gone to see, right? Nobody's going to be super scared if they see C-sharp code, okay? Have you not seen mine yet? I'll bet you it scares you. Okay. So really, what we want to do here is we're looking at two big short-term threats to food production globally right now. Okay, one is population growth and the other is climate change. Okay, these are the two big challenges that we've got. So what problem are we trying to help solve here? It's that of population. Okay, population growth more than anything else. Okay, so we look at population growth here. Over the short term, population growth seems to be quite steady these days. You know, if we look at, so along the x-axis here, we've got numbers of billions, and along the y-axis, we've got years to reach that. And you can see right at the left-hand side, it took us quite a bit of time to get from 1 billion to 2 billion people, but thereafter, from about 3 through to 10 billion, it's fairly constant, okay? But that's only a short-term, it's only the short-term view. If you have a look at the long-term view is exponential. All right, it's really sharp growth. And the trouble with that is, it's not just that there's going to be a whole bunch of people on the planet, it's a whole bunch of people want to be fed. All right, we don't just have them kicking around, these people need to be fed, and we have to be able to produce enough food to feed these people. And the thing is, it's not just feeding that we've got to do, all right? We have to house them as well. And housing them is actually an interesting problem, all right? You would think that there's a bunch of spaces, you can build houses wherever you want. There's a bunch of land. It shouldn't really impact on arable land. But it turns out that it does. And the reason that it turns out it does is because the land that's good for arable growth tends to have been at some point close to the water. Because all of that, you know, all the nutrients from the sea have been washed in, washed inland and have created good arable land. It tends to be south-facing. It tends to have a kind of moderate climate, not too rainy, not too sunny. Okay, those tend to be the best kinds of areas for growing crops. Turns out that's the kind of places that people want to live. You know, when you talk about housing and things like that, you always hear of people saying, you know, we have south-facing back gardens. It's always a big selling point. So people actually like to live in some of the best arable land that we have, certainly in the UK and in the world as well. Think about the UK, for example. We've got lots of nice places for growing arable land, but we've also got lots of scrub places up in, you know, the Peak District, up the mountains of Wales and places like that, where it'd be really, really tough to grow crops. Well, nobody wants to build housing schemes on the side of Mount Snowdon, for example. All right. So although we do have a bunch of space for producing food, we also want to build on pretty much the same ground. Another issue that we've got is What can we actually pull off of the land in terms of crop yield? You can see here some stats over here and over here. See, this is going to be awkward. And over here, you can see some stats around the kind of produce and the kinds of yields that we can pull off of the land. You know, if we're speaking about just a single acre of land there, you know, you can grow 50,000 pounds of tomatoes, possibly not in this country. You can grow 53,000 pounds of potatoes, 30,000 pounds of carrots, but only 250 pounds of beef. And that's a bit of an issue because we are predominantly not vegetarians in this country. Right, there are vegetarians, there are vegans, there's a whole you know, gamut of diets that people like to follow, but predominantly we are not vegetarian in this country. Okay, we are meat eaters. So really we're only looking at getting 250 pounds of beef from the same acre. Now that's going to give us an issue globally, because as developing economies like China and India move become more developed, they tend to move from a cuisine which is predominantly vegetarian to a cuisine which is predominantly protein-based. For the likes of China, for example, the pig production in China over the last 10 years has absolutely rocketed. Now, that's an issue because we can actually produce less pigs in the land than we could the predominantly vegetarian diets that they had in China and India. The second problem that we face right now is climate change, okay, and how it affects our ability to actually grow food. So we can see some statistics here. I'm just going to flash up some statistics that came from the Met Office. We have here, heat waves are going to become more frequent over the 20th century. Okay, so in summer of 2003, for example, Europe experienced a particularly extreme event, and we had a record loss of 36% of the crop yield. In Italy. So Italy lost more than a third of its crops just because of the heat. Here again, here's another issue. Irrigated agricultural land comprises less than a fifth of all cropped regions. Now what that means is irrigated is it's not watered entirely by rainfall. You know, we have to provide some water. So whether that's through ditches or whether it's actually with a giant hose pipe actually pushing water onto the land. So less than one-fifth of it is actually irrigated, but 40 to 45% of the world's food production comes from irrigated land, okay? And that's a problem because that water's got to come from somewhere. So we usually haul it out of rivers and stuff like that, which means downstream, the land downstream is then starved of water. Also becomes a problem where you have countries damming rivers, which then flow into other countries. So if you're going to have a problem with your water production and you decide to dam a river to solve your water production, but that river then flows through several neighboring countries on its way out to the sea, then you have deprived the downstream countries of a water source, okay? And then you've got to start asking yourself, you know, whether you have the right to do that kind of thing, you know, and what kind of, and right now when it's not a huge problem, it's not hugely controversial to dam and control river flows between countries. But you can imagine in the future where water shortages become a bigger problem, food production becomes a bigger problem, then you can imagine that that's going to cause an awful lot of geopolitical tension if you start to dam rivers and deprive other countries of water supplies. Over 80% of total agriculture is rain-fed in Latin America. It's close to 90, while in Africa it's 95. All right. So Latin America, 90%, Africa, 95% is rain-fed. That's going to be a problem because those are the areas around the equator where as climate change happens and we have global warming, the band around the equator where we can't grow crops because it's too hot, that's going to start to increase and that band is going to become wider and wider. And for countries like Africa, where they have 90% of their crop, it requires it to be rain-fed as that rain stops falling. Then they're going to have bigger and bigger problems going forward. In 2010, we'll remember this. I certainly remember it, and I'm sure people in the audience remember this, where they had the Russian drought, and it resulted in the wheat yield reduction of 40%. Remember, there were bread prices and everything went up as we import, here in the UK, we import a lot of our wheat from Russia, and they lost 40% of their crop because of the drought there. Southeast Asia, where the most vulnerable people live, in the river deltas. Okay, here we have they have the double whammy of a growing population, but the fact that the population likes to be confined and they live in those river deltas. Well, those river deltas where they're actually growing crops like now, they're going to be they are going to really struggle to be able to grow crops in those areas. So they're really going to suffer the double whammy of not being able to grow crops in that area, but at the same time, their population is growing rapidly. Those two problems, growing population, the fact that population requires to be fed and housed, and the fact that we're combating climate change right now, means we're going to have a very complex solution to those problems. Those problems are complex in themselves. You only have to look at the debate around climate change to understand how complex a problem that is. So any solution to those problems are in and of themselves going to be complex, obviously. But part of the solution, won't be the whole solution, but part of the solution is going to be maximizing crop yields. As the amount of land that we can actually use to grow crops diminishes, we have to be able to increase the yields of the crops that we can grow in those areas. So that's going to form part of the solution. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about for the rest of this talk. I was engaged with a company that was working with the European Space Agency to see what kind of things we can do to actually help to maximize crop yields right now. So I'm going to talk about a few things, some of the things we can actually do right now, and I'll tell you what those are. Some of the things we could do in the future, but it'd be a little bit tricky, and I'll speak about some of the problems around why they're tricky. And some of the other things are future work, which we could do, and we could probably do those with little to no effort, really. Okay. So the first one we're going to look at just now is preparing the ground. Before we even start to grow our crops, it's going to be important to prepare the ground. Okay, so that's going to be step one. And this is something that we can do right now. This is happening in the precision agricultural world right now. First of all, what happens is an agronomist will sample the soil. Okay, you can tell that this is probably a picture from the US, all right? This is not a UK-based agronomist. How can you tell? You can tell from two reasons. One, he's in a T-shirt, all right? Two, he's got all this expensive kit on a little ATV here, and there's no roof. All that kit is exposed to the outside. Okay, so you can pretty much tell from that picture that he's not expecting it to rain anytime soon. And because of that, you can tell he's not based in the UK. So what he's going to do there is he's going to go around and he's going to take a soil sample, probably at 50 meter squares around the field. All right, what that's going to do is that's going to give him a bunch of data points here. So we're going to have a latitude and a longitude, and we're going to have a value. In this case, we're looking at the pH of the field pH. And so he's going to get here a bunch of latitude and longitudes and a value for the pH. Now, bearing in mind, what we want to do is we want to make sure the pH of the soil in this field is absolutely optimal for growing whatever crop that we're going to plant. So what he's done so far is he's taken samples in 50 meter squares around the field, and that's fine. But what we need to do is we need to interpolate that for the full 50 by 50 meter grid, okay? So he's gone into a 50 by 50 meter grid and he's taken one soil sample. Well, that really just tells you what the soil sample is like there, right? But what we want to be able to do is to know what the soil condition is going to be like for the whole of that 50 by 50 meter grid. And what we're going to do is we're going to borrow a technique from geologists called kriging, right? It's called kriging. It's a technique. I won't go into the maths because it's really complicated. But basically what kriging allows you to do quickly, if we look at the blue, I wanted to say square there, but they've got rounded corners, and that's kind of thrown me. So they're not circles, but they're not squares either. So the blue undefined shapes, okay, are the actual values of the measurement that the guy took, okay? The two green lines represent the 95% confidence intervals, okay? So you can see confidence interval here, the confidence interval there, one actual reading there, one actual reading there. So we can interpolate that the reading actually follows this line here. The actual true value follows this line here. And this will give us a bunch of readings for the whole of the 50 by 50 meter grid. Okay, and this was a technique called kriging, devised by a geologist called Krieg, and it was actually for, I believe, finding gold in a gold mine. What he would do is he would sample at 50 meter intervals like that. He would use this statistical analysis to be able to say, well, there's probably going to be about this much gold in the mine, so we'll mine it or we won't. All right. We can actually borrow that same technique and say, well, if for this given sample, if this is the actual value of the pH in this given sample, we can use exactly the same technique following those confidence intervals, and we can say, well, actually the value for the whole 50 by 50 meter square is in probability going to be this value here. Once we've done that, what we can do is we can then create shape files, okay, because we've got everything we need. We have the latitude and the longitude, okay, and we have the actual values. And what we can do now is we can create shape files, and we can use Bing Maps, and we can add our shape file in here so we can see here's the pH values. And here we've got them both in numerical value and in color as well, so we can kind of see what they've done. And the map on the right is just, you know, coming out a little bit and seeing how we can look at all of the fields around this farm, okay? Once we've done that, what we can do is we can feed that information into what's called a variable rate applicator. What that actually does, the clue's in the name there, it applies something to a field in a rate which is variable. So what happens is you want to apply lime to change the pH of the field. Well, we want to apply lime here. And this map looks like this. So what happens is the tractor drives along here, and when it reaches the yellow part, it actually delivers lime in the quantities according to the legend here. When it hits the green, it does it in those quantities, and when it hits the red, it does it in that quantity, because it knows by the GPS positioning of the actual machine where about in the field you are, and it knows from the variable rate map that we created what tonnage it's supposed to be putting on the field right there. And now the tractor driver, all he has to do is to drive up and down the field, and the machine will do the rest of the work for him. And very soon, we won't even need the tractor driver to drive up and down the field. The farmer can actually be doing something, one, less boring, and two, more productive with his time than sitting driving up and down a field. We'll actually be able to use autonomous vehicles to do that. Now, we don't have autonomous vehicles right now, but we do have the ability to apply this variable rate lime. Okay, step two, monitoring the growth phase, all right? Those of you who are astute will notice that I missed a phase, okay, about planting and stuff like that. I don't want to talk about this right now because we can spend all afternoon talking about that and you can disappear down a rabbit hole talking about genetically modified seeds, okay? There's a lot of people have a lot of very strong feelings about genetically modified food and how it's really bad that we've been doing that. I don't intend to get into that argument, save to say that we have been genetically modifying food for hundreds, if not thousands of years, okay? If anybody really thinks that the dairy cattle that we have in the fields right now naturally evolved from the bison and other grass-eating herbivores that roamed the planet, okay, you're mistaken. And certainly if you think that the small dogs that A-list celebrities carry about in their handbags naturally evolved from wolves, right? Again, you are mistaken. We have been doing this kind of thing for centuries. It's probably safe. That's all I'm going to say about that. So what we want to do is monitor the growth phase. So once we've actually put our lime on the ground and we've selected our seeds and we've planted them and we're growing them, what can we then do in the whole Internet of Things framework to make sure that that is totally successful? And how we're going to do that is we're going to do this by machine vision. Now, this is something that we're not doing right now, but we could do with a little bit of hard work. So what we're going to do is, first thing we want to do is, we want to look at satellite or UAV imagery for something called NDVI. Okay, so what is NDVI? So NDVI is the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index. You can see why we just call it NDVI, right? I can never remember what those words what that actually stands for. Okay, what we're going to do here is we're going to take advantage of the fact that plants strongly reflect visible light in the 0.4 to 0.7 spectrum. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's green, okay? Plants strongly absorb light in the 0.7 to 1.1 wavelength, which is near infrared. So we know that they strongly reflect one wavelength of light and it strongly absorbs the other. So we can use this by saying that the NDVI equals the near infrared minus the visible light divided by the near infrared plus the visible light. So that's where you get normalized difference. Okay, so it's taking a normalized difference. And what that's going to do is that is going to give us a range of minus 1 to 1. Okay, so minus 1 is going to be absolutely no vegetation whatsoever. Okay, so places like the Arctic, the middle of the desert, you know, completely desolate places, you know, like Essex, you know, that kind of stuff. All right. Right to the other end of the extreme where we've got one where that is, it's all vegetation. So it's basically like you're looking down on the Amazon rainforest. Okay, that's the kind of thing you're going to see there. So minus one, no vegetation. Positive one, strong vegetation. Okay, now what we can do is we can then take a bunch of these readings. So over here, we're going to take a bunch of these readings. What we're going to say is, for each of the readings here, we're going to get the latitude and the longitude, right? We're going to carry out that NDVI reading, carry out that piece of simple arithmetic there. So grab that in, do the arithmetic, and then return those at the bottom. So there we can actually take a whole bunch, so from the satellite or from the UVA detector or even a detector in front of a tractor going over the field, we'll get a whole bunch of latitude and longitudes, and then we can actually calculate this NDVI. So we'll know for every single point in our field what the current NDVI is. All right. Now, if you're driving across the field, that's fine because it's all the one crop. If you're looking down from a satellite picture, if you're looking down from a UAV flight, that's slightly more complicated. All right. This is complicated because, as you can see, there's a whole bunch of different crops in that area, a whole bunch of different crops there, and there's a whole bunch of different crops, and they're in a different growth cycle. So every particular crop will be planted at a different time. It'll have different growth phases, okay? So at any given day, when you take a photograph, you've got a mixture of crops at a mixture of growth phases. And that's going to be slightly problematic because just being able to look down and say, well, the NDVI index down here is this number, won't really be able to help us at all. We'll have to know what the number is, we'll have to know what the crop is, and we'll have to know what phase of the growth cycle it's in. And to do that, this is why we don't do this right now, but it's something we could do with a little bit of work. What we will need is a whole bunch of citizen science. Citizen science has become popular in the last few years. I think SETI was the first people to do it, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They were using, they weren't really using citizens to do science, they were just using the spare compute cycles on their computers when they weren't being used. And now it's become a lot more popular. And citizens are getting a lot more advanced and a lot more into the actual science itself, right up to something that NASA are doing right now where you can sign up to take a look at astronomy photographs. And what you're actually doing is, as an amateur astronomer, you might not be skilled enough or have enough expertise to actually say, well, this is what I'm looking at, okay? But what you can have the expertise to do is to look at a picture and go, nope, that's just normal stars, I'm quite happy. Or you could say, actually, that looks a little bit odd. It doesn't look like what I think it should look like. A professional astronomer should take a look at this. You know, so you're providing a kind of Mechanical Turk way of doing classification. All right, and people are signing up to do that right now. What we could do is we could sign up, ideally farmers themselves, but other volunteers who would go into the fields at different crop times and different times through the crop phase and be able to record the latitude and longitude, the kind of crop that was planted there and what the growth phase they were in. And then what we do is we get a bunch of numbers like this that basically said, here's the latitude and longitude, here's the time of day, the month of the year, the crop type that was actually planted, and the week of its growth phase that we're actually in. And then we would build up a map throughout the UK of what crops were planted at what times and what aspects and which fields and stuff like that. And then we build up a map of what we'd expect the NDVI to actually look like. Okay? And then what we could do is we could have the same satellite fly over, the same UAV fly over, take a picture, okay? And then we could have the Internet of Things, people who were at the keynote this morning, we spoke there about the kind of analysis that you could do. You could run analysis on that stuff to say, well, actually, here's the actual readings. Now, once we have the actual readings and we know what we would predict it to be, what we can do is we can use a log linear regression. So we can say, well, this is the bunch of recorded data that we have from our citizen science, and this is the actual recorded data. And what we can do there is we can say, well, actually, this is what I expect it to be from the log linear regression. Here's what the actual number is. That's fine, in which case I'm going to ignore that. Or actually, this is a problem. You should go look. Okay. Now, the reason you should say you should go look is before we want to tell the farmer that he may or may not have a problem, what we actually want to do is have someone look at that picture from the satellite or the UAV first of all. And the reason you want to do that is because farmers are a pain in the ass. All right? They will go at the end of the day, do you know what? I'm just going to leave this tractor here because I'm going to need it in this field first thing in the morning, so there's no point in driving it back. So I'm just going to leave it here and get a lift up the road. All right? And then the UAV or the satellite flies over and it takes a picture. And it goes, well, that's not the NDVI that I expected to see. But you need a human to look at that to go, well, the reason that that's not the NDVI you expected to see is because that's a tractor. It's not the field. Okay, the crop's actually under the tractor. You can't see it. So we can ignore that one because that tractor isn't going to be there tomorrow. All right. But then once somebody, a human, has looked at that and gone, nope, that is actual crop, then we can say to the farmer, look, our system has detected that the yield is not, the NDVI index is not what it should be. This crop is not thriving for whatever reason that is, okay? And then the farmer can take remedial action. The good thing about that, and the reason we want to do that, is because you can detect changes in the NDVI 7 to 10 days before the farmer walking the field could actually see that the crop wasn't thriving, okay? So before the crop is actually showing outward signs of not thriving, we would know that it wasn't thriving. And at that point, if we can take remedial action, we can actually save the yield of that crop. So if you're talking about a third of the field, for example, that wasn't thriving, instead of losing perhaps half of that third because the crop wasn't thriving and the yield, we wouldn't get the full yield, we'll actually be able to pull the full yield out of it properly by fixing that. We use the log linear equation here, which kind of looks horrible when you see it first time around, but basically that's just your linear regression algorithm there, this bit at the end here. Whoops, where did the pointer go? There, this bit at the end here, you'll recognize that. And really, the 1 over plus 1 to the power, all that really does is to constrain that between 0 and 1. Because, of course, linear regression means you could stretch on in both directions infinitely. Well, we know we can't because we know we're constrained between 0 and 1 because we already know that anything below 0 is no vegetation at all, and actually anything above 1, well, the scale only goes to 1. So we're going to use that to constrain our value between 0 and 1. So we can use that to make our predictions. One of the other things that we can do, and we can do this right now, although we don't, is we can use UEVs or satellite imagery, and we can do crop counting and weed detection. Okay? So to do that, what we're going to do is our UAV or our satellite is going to fly over a field. It's going to take a picture of some crops. Okay, in this case, it's potato plants. All right. So what it's going to do then, we want to count the potato plants. All right. So we're going to use two canonical examples of machine learning here to do this. We're going to use, first of all, we're going to use classification. And second of all, we're going to use clustering. Okay, the two canonical examples of machine learning. So the first of all, a computer, when we look at this, we can see, yes, that's potato plants, so we can recognize that. But a computer doesn't see that. A computer just sees a bunch of pixels, right? And in this case, it sees a bunch of pixels and a whole mass of different colors, all right? Well, we don't want to do that. We want it to see just the things we're interested in and the things that we're not interested in. So that's what we've got to do. Our first piece of classification has to be stuff, in this case pixels, pixels I'm interested in, pixels I'm not interested in. And so it does the classification and it ends up, the computer then ends up seeing an image that looks like this. Okay, where white is all the pixels that it's interested in and black is all the stuff that it's not interested in. Thereafter, what it wants to do is it wants to say, now that I've separated pixels that I'm interested in from pixels that I'm not, what I want to do is I want to cluster those. I want to cluster the pixels that I'm interested in together, and then I want to cluster the, I want to count the clusters, and that will tell me how many plants that I've got in that image. Okay. In this particular example, I have colored in the clusters so that you can actually see that the machine did it properly and actually saw the different clusters. Obviously, different colors, the computer software itself doesn't have to do that in order to count them. That's just for our benefit. Okay, so how did we actually do that? So like I said, first thing we did was we classified each pixel. So what we do here is if we have a look at this, we've got a classification. So what we do is, a bit of walking around, you see what I do is I run through each of the pixels in the screen. So I walk the pixels in the image, okay? And then having done that, what I do is I say, I'm going to check for a particular greenness threshold, all right? And if we've reached that greenness threshold, I'm going to set the color to white because I'm interested in it. And if it's not, then I'm going to turn it to black because I'm not interested in it, which is all well and good, but what is this greenness threshold? How do I create that? Well, what I do here is, in this particular algorithm, what I do is I create here, right at the top, first line, I create a intensity histogram, right? And what the intensity histogram is I just create an array from 0 to 255, all right? And again, what I do is I walk through the pixels there, and what I do is I take the color. And what I do is I take the color, and I say I want the green part of this color. And then what I want to do is I want to increment the counter for that intensity of green. So I've got intensities 0 through 255. Okay, I say, what intensity is this? And then in a dictionary, I actually just go and I say, right, I want to increment the counter because I found another pixel at that intensity. I found another pixel at that intensity. Okay, here I want to show off an awesome thing about C sharp because it never fails to amaze me. Here, I ask for a pixel. I say, get pixel, what do you think get pixel would return you? Yes, you would think it returns you a pixel. Actually, look, it returns you a color. Okay, where are we? Here. Get pixel actually returns a color, and then from the color you ask for the greenness of it. So you say to C sharp, give me a pixel. And C sharp says, certainly, here's a color. All right? Okay, so once I've built that histogram, then I return it there at the bottom. Okay, so back in here, what I've done is I take this histogram, and what I do is I skip the first one because the first one is the zeroth intensity, and zero intensity of green is no green at all. So I can skip the first one. And then what I do is I take the remaining parts of that histogram and I create an average. So I take and I get an average intensity. The next thing I have to do down here is the average intensity might not actually be an intensity in the green that I've got. So what I do is I use this algorithm here to find the nearest intensity that I've got to the average. And once I found that nearest intensity to the average, I find the frequency. Sorry, the other way around. What I do is I calculate, the average frequency. Then I find the nearest frequency that I actually have to the average. And then once I find that frequency, I return the intensity at that average frequency and I say, this is my threshold. Everything which is green enough to get to this threshold, I'm interested in. Stuff that's not that green, I'm not that interested in. And then what we do is we cluster the pixels. Okay, so to cluster the pixels, what we're going to do here is, again, we're going to walk through the image. Now this time, we're only interested in the ones which are white, because we've already done our classification. So I only have to pay attention to the white ones. And then once I've found the white ones, what I do there is I say, for everything, what I want to do is I want to cluster the point. Now what I'm gonna do, the algorithm I'm gonna use to cluster the point is called weighted distance, k nearest neighbor. Okay, so that's quite a mouthful, so I'm going to unpack it for you, all right? So let's say, for example, I want to cluster people who are sat here, all right? So let's unpack that sentence. So first of all, we'll start with nearest neighbor. So what I want to do is, if I want to cluster you to say what cluster you're going to be in, I'll ask your nearest neighbors if you should be in their cluster. So ask this gentleman, and then I'll ask you, and everybody gets a vote, okay, as to who you're closest to. So that's the nearest neighbor. Nearest neighbors get a vote, all right? And then we have K, nearest neighbor. So what is the K? The K is how many clusters are there? Now, there are two ways to do that. You can actually tell the algorithm, I want you to cluster these people into four clusters, okay? But in our case, the actual clusters represent the plants themselves. So if I was able to tell the algorithm how many plants it should cluster into, I would know how many plants there were. So I wouldn't need to do that. So the other way of doing it is a heuristic. And heuristic is just a posh scientific word for rule of thumb. All right? So we need a rule of thumb for actually determining how many Ks, how many clusters are going to be. And I'll speak about that as I go through the algorithm. And the last part is weighted distance. Weighted distance means I want to create a linear function, which means that neighbors who are closer, their vote should count for more, okay? Because if I was, say, I wanted to cluster this gentleman, and if I was to ask this gentleman, and you two, then obviously this gentleman's vote should count for more than your vote because he is nearer, okay? You're all near neighbors, but he is the nearest neighbor, so his vote should count for more. So that is weighted distance, K nearest neighbor. And that's the algorithm that we're going to use in this part here, where we ask it to cluster the points. So what we're going to do here to do that is, what we do is we start at the top here and we say, I'm going to get all of the near neighbors, and then what I'm going to do is I want to, so here's the part of where we start to come up with our rule of thumb, our heuristic. If there are no, if this is the first point I'm looking for, right, and there are no clusters right now, then this must be the root point of the first cluster I'm dealing with. So that's easy enough. So there's a piece of the heuristic straight away that says, how many Ks shall I have? However, if I already have one, what I actually need is I need to get the clustered point for this, okay? So how I do that is I say, get me all the near neighbors for this cluster, okay? And a neighbor is just a point which is closer than a distance threshold that I set. Here we see the isNeighbor function is just an extension function I've written into the point class, which basically takes a point which is already clustered, a test point that I want to test against, and a threshold that I want to specify. And then I say, if this distance between the clustered point and the test point is less than or equal to the threshold, then it is a neighbor, okay? And here, distance from is just another extension method which I've written into the point class, which is just the Euclidean distance between two points, okay? It's a straight distance between two points, and that's how that works. So what I then do is, for each of the neighbors that I've got, then what I do is I say, for each of the voting neighbors that I've got, I want each neighbor to vote for the point, okay? So here what happens then, vote for the point is again another extension method that I've written. It takes a point which is already clustered and it's getting to vote. It takes our test, point and it takes a threshold. And there you can see I do that again. It does the distance, okay, between the voting point and the test that I want. So that's our distance, but I said it was a weighted distance, and doing this one divided by the distance gives us our weighting. So if the distance between the two points was 10, then that vote would be 1 over 10. If the distance was 100, that vote would be 1 over 100. So there we've created our linear function, which actually weights the nearer neighbors stronger than the more distant neighbors. Then what we do is we say, then it's just a simple case of saying, well, now that I've counted all the votes, what is the current high votes? If the high vote number that I've got now is higher than the current high votes, this is going to be my new candidate cluster. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to swap the clusters. And then at the end, once I've finished that, the cluster with the highest number of votes is the cluster that I'm going to return to say this point should live in this cluster, okay? And then all I do is, the second part of the heuristic then, I say, if I found a cluster, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to add that point to the cluster. The next part of the heuristic says, but if I didn't find a cluster, if there was no clear winner, or I had no neighbors, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this point to be the root node of a next cluster. And that combined with the one we've got at the start is going to give us our heuristic for working out how many k's we have to have in our weighted distance key nearest neighbor algorithm. And in the end, we're going to return that. And that's how we do all that clustering. The next thing we're going to look at, the last thing we're going to look at before we finish, is weed detection. Okay, and we can do this right now as well. So can we detect weeds inside of a crop? Okay, so if we take an aerial view of a piece of ground, you can see here that there is a weed in here that we can see. It's called black grass. Okay, it grows in all kinds of arable crops. It's the darker colored crop here. Now, black grass is a bit of a misnomer because it's not actually black, right? It gets its name because it is very slightly darker than the surrounding crop around it, okay? But it is a detectable color difference between the crop and the weed, and we're going to use that color difference. What we're going to do is we're going to use another canonical example in machine learning. Again, classification. We want to classify a pixel as being probably crop or probably weed, okay? And we're going to use Bayesian inferencing to do that. So first of all, what we need is we need a sample of a picture where we know its actual crop and a sample of the picture where we know its actual black grass. And then we're going to use the Bayesian classification to actually color then the crop in the picture black if it's probably black grass, and we're going to leave it alone if it's probably crop. Okay, so here we can see the black grass more clearly. And actually, from this image here, we can see that there's more black grass in the picture than we first thought, because the difference, variation between the colors wasn't necessarily good enough in the image for us to see it so well. But now that we've run the algorithm, we can see there's much more black grass. Another advantage of us doing that algorithm, doing it through software, is that we've actually colored all of those pixels. Okay, so we know exactly what percentage of the pixels in any given space are crop. What that allows us to do then is to draw a shape around a field like this and say, well, how much black grass is in there? So here, this part is 95% black grass, and we do another part and we can say, well, how much black grass is in that area? Now, the reason this is important is because black grass is a really nasty weed. It's a nasty weed because it has evolved to grow and turn to seed before the crop turns to seed. So what that means is if you're a farmer and you leave that weed in your field, that is going to grow, it's going to seed, and the seeds are going to fall into your field before your crop is ready to harvest. So if you leave it, next year you'll have even more black grass. So right now, the only thing to do is to take the nuclear option and to put herbicide on your field. So basically, the farmer would look at this field and he would write off the whole field, which obviously has knock-on consequences in terms of our yield, okay? Because he's going to say, no, I'm going to write off my investment in this field. I'm just going to put down herbicide on the field this year, knowing that I won't have black grass in the field next year because I'll have killed it. Unfortunately, I will have killed the crop as well. What this allows us to do is to say, well, actually, is there any parts of this which are savable? Right? We only have to put, using the same variable application technology that I spoke about before, we only have to put herbicide on the actual parts which are under a certain level. Which are above a certain level of black grass. Under that level, we might be able to harvest that, and actually it's still economically viable to separate the weed from the crop once we've actually harvested it. So we can actually save some of the crop, which is good for the farmer because he saves some of his money, but it's good for us as well because we've increased the yield. Instead of getting nothing in terms of yield from that field, at least we'll get something now. Okay, so how do we do this? What we do, first of all, is to detect the black grass, what we do is we create the probability distribution for it to being a crop, we create a probability distribution for it being grass, and then what we do is we say, color the bitmap based on whether or not, based on the probabilities. So, first of all, creating a probability distribution is just a case of, again, creating the color intensity histograms that we talked about before. One for the crop, because we give it a sample that it says absolutely crop. We absolutely know that this is crop, so it will create a histogram in exactly the same way as I already explained in terms of the intensity. We do exactly the same thing for the sample that is weed. So now we have a probability distribution for crop, we have a probability distribution for weed. Once we have those two things then, we can go through and we can say, I want you to color the bitmap. Sorry, down here, we're going to color the bitmap appropriately. Okay, this part here, color the bitmap appropriately. So to do that, what we want to do is we want to calculate here the probability that any given pixel is black grass or not. Down here, calculate the probability that any given pixel is black grass or not. And to do that, we're going to use Bayesian classification or the Bayesian inferencing. Before I show you the code, it'll make much more sense if we understand how Bayesian classification works. So this is the equation for Bayesian classification, and it is absolutely simple. For such a powerful machine learning technique, that is an extremely simple algorithm. It looks a little bit complicated when you first see it written down because some of the syntax, we don't know how to say some of the syntax. But basically what this says is, what is the probability of event A happening? And this straight bar here is read as given that. So what is the probability that event A happens given that event B has already happened? And that's calculated by this probability here. So if I say it in general terms, it sounds a bit weird. It's easier to put it into concrete terms. So to put it into concrete terms, let's talk about horse racing, for example, and gambling. So if it was horse racing, we would say, what is the probability that this horse will win given that this jockey is riding it? To calculate that, you say, well, what is the probability of that jockey winning given that that horse is being ridden? So basically, has that jockey ridden that horse before and won? Multiplied by the probability of that horse winning regardless of who's riding, divided by the probability of that jockey winning regardless of which horse he's riding. Okay, so a very straightforward algorithm. Now, this actually breaks down into different parts. This part here is called the posterior probability. It's called posterior because it's the probability that comes out of the end. Once you've done all the calculations, that... keep it clean. That's the probability that comes out of the end once you've done all of your calculations. This part here is known as the likelihood function, and that says how probable is the evidence given that the hypothesis is correct. So assuming that we are correct, how likely is it that we'd see that piece of evidence that we want to judge? This part here is called the prior, and that is the prior probability, and that represents the probability of that thing, event A, happening before we consider this piece of evidence, okay? And this part at the bottom is called the marginal, and that says, well, how probable is the evidence under all possible circumstances? So as I say, how likely is it that that jockey would win regardless of what horse he was riding? Okay, so those are the parts: posterior, likelihood function, prior, and marginal. And the way we can actually take into consideration multiple pieces of evidence is that the posterior probability, after we've looked at one piece of evidence, becomes the prior probability when we look at the second piece of evidence. So we just continually cycle that around until we run out of evidence. Because remember, the prior probability represents what we thought would happen before we look at this piece of evidence. So here, you can see the code is just lines up nicely with that. So we've got our likelihood function, our prior function, our marginal, and then we say that just in exactly the same way as we showed, the likelihood equals the prior divided by the marginal. Okay, and that is basically all that I want to speak about today. We've covered things that we can do to increase yield that we can do right now, things that we can do but would be a little bit of effort because we require citizen scientists, and things that we don't do right now but we absolutely could, like this stuff here for weed detection and crop counting, okay? There's nothing to stop us doing that. Technology exists right now to do that, okay? I'm right hard up against time. I don't want to steal any time from the next speaker setting up his stuff before the next talk starts at 20 past, but I'm more than happy to take questions as we kind of clear up here. So if you do have any questions, then please feel free to come up and ask them, And if you don't, thanks very much for coming to the talk, and I hope you guys learned something. Thanks very much.